Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America, designed for people like you who are learning American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington. Every day of the year on this program, we bring you news from and about the United States and the world. Because this program is produced for learners of American English, like you, we speak a little slower than normal, and we use words and phrases that are easy to understand. Listen to the program, then practice saying the words and sentences the way we do. It's a free and easy way to improve your American English skills every day of the year. This is what you will hear on today's program. In our weekly higher education report, correspondent Pete Musto will tell us about a new effort by the Harvard Business School, one of the most famous graduate schools in the world. The school has opened what it calls a startup studio in New York City. The project is designed to help recent graduates develop their ideas into real operating companies.
We have over 8,000 alumni here, and so we thought it would be a great place to put down a stake, especially with all the entrepreneurial activity happening here.
Then you will hear Words and Their Stories, one of our most popular programs. This week, Anna Mateo is talking about expressions related to numbers. Why? Well, you do the math. And finally, we will present The Making of a Nation. Today, we will tell you about Germany's attack on Poland and the start of World War II in Europe. It presented a problem for Americans in September 1939. Most Americans did not like Germany's Nazi leader Adolf Hitler. They hoped for victory for Britain, France, and the other Allied powers. But few Americans had a desire to fight in another world war. So you can see, as always, we have a lot for you today. So let's get started. Here's Pete Musto.
Harvard Business School is one of the most famous graduate schools in the world. Part of Harvard University, the Boston, Massachusetts-based school has offered programs leading to master's and doctorate degrees since 1908. And earlier this year, a Harvard education took some future business leaders to a city outside Massachusetts. The school opened the Harvard Business School Startup Studio in New York City in January. But the Startup Studio is not actually for current Harvard students. It is designed to help recent HBS graduates develop their ideas into actual companies. Competition in the business world can be fierce. That is why some cities are seeing a growth of companies with the stated purpose of helping other businesses get their start. These companies, often called incubators, are very common in the technology industry. Incubators can reduce barriers for small, young companies with little money. They provide resources, workspace, and other services to the companies. In return, these startups often give some of their profits to the incubators if they are successful. However, the Harvard Business School Startup Studio has no interest in sharing the profits of any startup company. Avani Patel is the director of the Startup Studio. She says the purpose is to provide business advice and workspace. Another reason is to bring together the many former Harvard students living in New York.
We have over 8,000 alumni here, and so we thought it would be a great place to put down a stake, especially with all the entrepreneurial activity happening here.
The program's offices are in the Union Square neighborhood of Manhattan. Inside, employees from several startups work on everything from healthcare to media while sharing the same office space. There are several requirements that a startup must meet before the program accepts them. The company must already have secured at least $500,000 in financing from an outside source. Also, at least one person in the company must be an alumnus of Harvard Business School. Each company gets enough workspace for up to 7 people. They can stay as long as they like. But Patel predicts every company in the program will grow and need to find its own bigger space at some point. This enables new companies to enter the program. Member Joshua Haas founded Bubble, a computer programming tool that lets people create application software without learning how to code. Haas says one of the most difficult parts of starting a company is knowing how to move the business forward.
You're responsible for everything, and you have to make stuff happen.
Before working in the startup studio, Haas worked from his home or in coffee shops. He says being in a community of other startups helped him improve.
If you have people you can show off what you're working on to, that's motivation to get up in the morning to do it.
Creating relationships with other companies and business people is very important for new businesses. That is why Director Patel says the program connects alumni with people working in different fields.
So when they are thinking they need to speak to a digital expert, we have access to people who they can speak to. Or if somebody's fundraising, we've got the relationships with investors.
I'm Pete Musto.
Thanks, Pete. Now, here's Ana Mateo with a look at some American English expressions that involve doing the math.
Hello, and welcome to Words and Their Stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we explain how to use common expressions in American English. We also explore the origins of these expressions. Where do they come from? Today, we are talking about expressions related to numbers. Why? Well, you do the math. VOA does a lot of programs, and sooner or later, we were going to get to this one. The verbal phrase, do the math, means to examine the facts and figures to reach a conclusion, especially when the answer is very clear. For example, let's say I love animals. I spend all my savings on caring for stray cats and dogs. When my friend asks why I never go on vacation, I can simply point to my 7 cats and 5 dogs and say, money for vacations? You do the math. Of course, before children can do even basic math, they must learn to count. But counting numbers is not the only meaning of the word count. Consider a famous quote by the scientist Albert Einstein. He reportedly said, "Not everything that counts can be counted. Not everything that can be counted counts." This quote is a pun, a play on words. It plays with two meanings of the word count. Count means to determine the total number of something. It also means to have value or importance. Things that matter and things that are important count. Let's hear count used in a dialogue. These two friends are talking about an upcoming U.S. election. Take note that a third definition of count, meaning depend, is used.
Are you voting in November?
Why should I? My vote doesn't count.
What do you mean it doesn't count? After they close the polls, workers count all the votes.
What I mean is that voters in D.C. don't have representatives in Congress. So even though my vote for president is officially counted, my opinion about what should happen in my own neighborhood doesn't count. And many people in D.C. are sick of it. You can count on that.
Oh, that's right. I didn't count that fact. I live in Maryland and have 10 representatives in Congress, so my voice does count more than yours.
That is a lot of counting. After counting, many children learn to solve simple addition problems. They learn that 1 plus 1 equals 2, and 2 plus 2 equals 4, and so on and so on. However, as we get older, we learn that things often don't add up so simply. Things that should make sense sometimes don't, as in this example.
Hi.
Hey. Welcome to another Monday at work.
Yeah, thanks. Hey, why is Marissa's purse on her desk? I thought she started her vacation today.
Maybe it's her second purse. Women do carry more than one purse, you know.
I know that. It's just odd. She never leaves her purse.
Hey, what are you doing? It's rude to go through someone's purse.
I know, but I have a bad feeling. Look, here are her house keys, her wallet, even her plane ticket. It says she's flying out today.
You're right. That doesn't add up. Something might be wrong. Why don't you go to her apartment, and I'll call her boyfriend.
I hope Marissa is okay.
I know.
I'm Anna Mateo.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.
Thanks, Anna. Now we present The Making of a Nation. Germany's attack on Poland and the start of World War II in Europe presented a problem for Americans in September 1939. The United States, by law, was neutral, and few Americans had any desire to fight in another world war. But most Americans did not like Germany's Nazi leader, Adolf Hitler. They hoped for victory for Britain, France, and the other Allied powers. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt made this clear in a radio broadcast to Americans soon after the war began.
The overwhelming masses of our people seek peace. Peace at home. And the kind of peace in other lands which will not jeopardize our peace at home. We have certain ideas and certain ideals of national safety, and we must act to preserve that safety today. and to preserve the safety of our children in future years. That safety is and will be bound up with the safety of the Western Hemisphere and of the seas adjacent thereto. We seek to keep war from our own firesides by keeping war from coming to the Americas.
He praised the British and other allies. Finally, the president called on Congress to change the neutrality laws that prevented him from sending arms to the Allies to help them fight Germany. Congress agreed to change the laws so foreign nations could buy American arms. In the months that followed, Hitler and his allies claimed one victory after another. German and Soviet troops captured Poland quickly in September of 1939. Then Soviet forces invaded the small Baltic nations of Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania. In late November, they attacked Finland. Fighting between Finland and the Soviet Union continued through the winter until Finland accepted Russia's demands. Fighting grew even more fierce the following spring in 1940. Germany attacked Denmark and Norway, defeating them easily. In May, German forces struck like lightning through Belgium and Holland. Within one day, they were in France. British and French forces were unable to stop the Germans from moving deep into northern France. The British finally had to flee from the European continent. They sailed back to Britain from the French town of Dunkirk. German soldiers marched through France, and Italian forces joined them by invading France from the south. Soon, Paris fell.
Gilt den Verwundeten, die ihr Blut für diesen herrlichen Sieg gaben, der überall an der Front wie in der Heimat unbeschreiblich.
These are German newsreel narrators describing German troops entering Paris and the fall of the French government.
Der Ministerpräsident der neu gebildeten französischen Regierung, Marshal Pétain, hat in einer Rundfunkansprache.
A German supporter, Marshal Pétain, took control of the French government, and France, beaten and crushed, was forced to sign a peace treaty with Hitler. Now it was just Britain alone against Hitler and his Axis allies. Only the English Channel separated the British people from a German army that seemed unbeatable. British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain was forced to resign. The British people turned to a new leader, Winston Churchill.
I speak to you for the first time as Prime Minister in a solemn hour for the life of our country, of our empire, of our allies, and above all, of the cause of freedom. A tremendous battle is raging in France and Flanders. The Germans, by a remarkable combination of air bombing and heavily armored tanks, have broken through the French defenses north of the Maginot Line, and strong columns of their armored vehicles are ravaging the open country, which for the first day or two was without defenders. They have penetrated deeply and spread alarm and confusion in their track.
Churchill would prove to be strong and brave in the long months ahead. The British would need strong leadership. Hitler wasted no time in launching a fierce air attack on Britain. Throughout the summer, German and British planes fought above the English Channel. All of this military action had an important effect on American popular opinion. War and neutrality were no longer just ideas to be discussed and debated. Now they were real concerns, real events. fascist troops led by a dictator in Berlin were defeating one friendly democracy after another, and Soviet forces were on the march too. Most Americans still wanted neutrality, but how long could America remain at peace? And was peace worth the cost of just sitting by and watching friends like France and Britain being bombed and invaded? Other issues melted away as Americans began to consider what to do about the darkening world situation. Some Americans, led by newspaper publisher William Allen White, called for the United States to help Britain immediately. But other groups, like the America First Committee, demanded that the United States stay out of another bloody European conflict. The struggle between those who wanted to help Britain and those who wanted to remain neutral did not follow traditional party lines. Some of the strongest supporters of Roosevelt's foreign policies were Republicans. Some members of his own Democratic Party opposed his policies. Even so, foreign policy was one of the main issues in the presidential election campaign of 1940. The Democrats once again nominated Franklin Roosevelt for president. The Republicans had several popular candidates who were interested in campaigning against Roosevelt. At first, it seemed that these candidates would fight it out in a bitter nominating convention in Philadelphia. But to everyone's surprise, a little-known candidate named Wendell Willkie suddenly gained a great deal of support and won the nomination.
For the building of an adequate defense, so that no dictator, however strong, may seek to strike, for the unity of our people, for calling again America to its great tradition of progress, I pledge myself to you, and I ask each of you to join with me in this great crusade.
Willkie was a tough candidate. He was friendly, a good businessman, and a strong speaker. He seemed honest, and he seemed to understand foreign policy. Most importantly, Willkie had a progressive record on many social issues. He was not the kind of traditional conservative Republican that Roosevelt had defeated so easily in his first two campaigns. Instead, Willkie could claim to represent the average American just as well as Roosevelt, and he offered the excitement of a change in leadership. While Roosevelt and Willkie began their campaign battles with words, German and British planes were fighting real battles with bullets over the English Channel. Winston Churchill sent a desperate message to Roosevelt. The British Prime Minister said Britain could not fight alone much longer. It needed help immediately. Roosevelt did not want to take steps toward war just before an election, but neither could he refuse such an urgent appeal from the British leader. Roosevelt and Willkie discussed the situation. Willkie agreed not to criticize Roosevelt when the president sent 50 ships to the British Navy. He also supported Roosevelt's order for American young men to give their names to Army officials so they could be called up if fighting began. In this way, Roosevelt and Willkie tried to keep America's growing involvement in the war from becoming a major political issue in the election. President Roosevelt won the election of 1940. He won 27 million votes to 22 million for Willkie. This made Roosevelt the first and only president in American history to win a third term in the White House. The Constitution was later changed to limit presidents to two terms. Soon after the election, President Roosevelt received a letter from Winston Churchill. The British Prime Minister wrote that Britain urgently needed more arms and planes to fight Germany. Roosevelt agreed. He went to the Congress to plead for more aid to Britain. He said the United States should change its neutral policy because Britain was fighting a common enemy of democracy. Roosevelt also said the United States could avoid war if Britain was strong enough to defeat Germany by itself. Congress agreed, after a fierce debate, to increase aid to Britain. And in the weeks and months that followed, the United States moved closer and closer to open war with Germany. In March of 1941, Roosevelt allowed British ships to come to American ports to be repaired. In June, the United States seized ships under German control. It also took over German and Italian funds in American banks. Open fighting could not be prevented with this increase in tension between Germany and the United States. In September 1941, a German submarine fired at an American ship. The ship was not damaged, but a number of American troops were killed in other naval incidents that followed.
By the end of 1941, the United States and Germany were almost at war. Even so, most Americans continued to hope for peace. In fact, few Americans could guess that war was just days away. The first blow would come not from Germany, however, but from Japan. We will tell that part of the story tomorrow here on Learning English. A reminder, we now bring you The Making of a Nation on Sundays and Mondays on this program. This Making of a Nation program was written by David Jarmul. It was presented and produced by Steve Ember, and we thank them both. You can find the entire Making of a Nation series online with transcripts, MP3s, and images at learningenglish.voanews.com. While you are visiting our website, you can also read and listen to longer versions of the stories that you have just heard on this program. You can also read, listen to, and download our other programs. And you will find captioned videos and lessons to test your American English skills. We'd like to hear from you. Send us an email. Our address is learningenglish@voanews.com. You can also send us a message through our website. Please know that however you reach us, we do read every message you send. You can follow us on Facebook, LinkedIn, iTunes, Twitter, and on our YouTube channel, all at VOA Learning English. And be sure to listen to VOA World News at the beginning of every hour, Universal Time, every day of the year. Well, that's our program for today. We hope it has informed and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from Washington. For all of us here at VOA Learning English, thanks for spending some time with us today. I hope you'll join us tomorrow for another Learning English program from the Voice of America.